station.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Writers write because they feel they have something to say. They can only hope that someone reads what they've written. Finding readers has never been an easy process, especially for new writers. Getting an agent and a publisher was always a difficult task. But the digital revolution has stood that process on its ear. Even as major publishing houses are becoming more selective and encouraging their stable of writers to write more of the same, the digital revolution has ushered in an era of self-publishing. Random House won't take you, okay? So what? Just publish your own great American novel all by yourself. But even that has its pitfalls. So how have the realities of being or becoming a published writer changed? And what implications does this new reality have on writers and what they write? To talk about that, we've invited three successful local writers to join us. Maury Creech is the author of three collections of poetry. His most recent, The Sleep of Reason, was a finalist for the 2014 Pulitzer Prize. He is writer in residence at Queen's University of Charlotte, where he teaches courses in creative writing and poetry. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. Cynthia Lewis is back with us. She is a creative nonfiction writer who is currently finishing her latest book, The Games Afoot, Sports and Shakespeare. It turns out that Shakespeare is one of the subjects she teaches as the Dana Professor of English at Davidson College. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Mike.
And last time I saw you were in a bikini, and you're all bundled up this morning. She wrote with some friends a book about the bikini culture in Davidson, of all places. That's what I'm alluding to there. And Aaron Gwynn is the author of a short story collection and two novels, the most recent of which is Wind's War. He, too, is a professor, this time of English at UNC Charlotte, where he teaches fiction writing and contemporary American fiction. Welcome to you.
Thank you, sir.
Before we talk about what's going on with writing and publishing in today's world, let's talk about the three of you. Let's begin with you, Maury. You're a poet, but you grew up in Monk's Corner. Not exactly, I would think, not fertile ground for a poet. How did that happen for you?
Well, I come from a family that tells a lot of stories, and so I started off wanting to be a fiction writer, actually. But discovered when I was in my 20s that I was more interested in the sound of words, the sounds of words and the sounds of language than I was the stories themselves. Huh. So I took a class when I was in community college with a professor named Chris Forehan, who's a poet. And he would sit cross-legged on the desk and read these poems in a way that made it sound – the poems sounded like they mattered for the first time. I'd never heard poems intoned in such a way, and he had the audacity to read poets who were recently dead. I thought you had to be thoroughly dead to be a poet. but these poets, you know, had written in the 50s and 60s, and so they sounded somewhat contemporary, and I had no idea that you could write about your own times and your own struggles in a way that didn't sound like Keats or something like that. And
one of your favorites, by
the way. Who is one of my favorite poets. So I kind of discovered poetry backwards. I started with the 50s and 60s and moved backwards in my reading.
And yet I read an article about you in which one of your early teachers in college said that you came pretty much fully grown. You knew precisely what you wanted to be, and you knew everything about poetry, and you knew all of the great poets. And you were so far ahead of everybody else in your class, but you still humbly helped others along the way. You came to that experience fully developed. How so? How did that happen?
Well, the poet that I was introduced to by Professor Forehan was a poet named John Berryman. And Berryman just became a passion of mine. I read everything of Berryman's, and then I read Berryman's biography by a fellow poet named Paul Mariani, wrote a biography of him. And in the biography, he would mention the people that Berryman read or admired. So, you know, there's a poet named John Milton. I should probably read John Milton. He likes Rilke. I should probably read Rilke. So I started reading the things that I discovered in the biography and sort of tried to read everything that I could. And that's sort of how I kind of got a sense of what poetry was about.
And Cynthia, you are a writer of creative nonfiction, which sounds like an oxymoron. So how creative can you get when you write nonfiction?
That's a great question.
time was when you could maybe get a little bit more creative than you can now after the Fry scandal. Hmm. You know, a million little pieces?
That's right.
Where he was found to have manufactured material that he was presenting as facts. And so these days, I think a lot is made of grounding nonfiction in facts. You really can't make anything up. But what's creative about creative nonfiction is your treatment of facts using elements and devices that derive from fiction writing. So you can use characterization. You can have much more of a voice as an author than you could, say, in journalistic writing. You can be more descriptive. You can use dialogue. And so you may be reading a piece of nonfiction that reads very much like fiction, but it's fact-based.
So is Bill O'Reilly's book, for instance, about Lincoln, is that creative nonfiction or is that fiction?
I'm embarrassed to say I haven't read it.
Okay.
But
no, that's okay. You don't have to be embarrassed to say you haven't read Bill O'Reilly.
I'm actually not that embarrassed, but but there's a close relative.
Well, let's use a movie as an example.
Okay.
The JFK movie, which the work of
Oliver Stone.
Oliver Stone, fiction or creative nonfiction?
Well, I think there's a lot of speculation in that movie. Actually, I'm not very well versed in that movie either. But
what I'm trying to get at is how do you know you haven't crossed the line from nonfiction, where you're trying to tell the story as it happened, the true facts? But you've crossed into fiction where you're just making things up. You're applying characteristics to the characters that really didn't exist, or thoughts to the characters that they really didn't think, or things to the characters, sayings that they said, but they didn't really say them.
All right. These are all pretty much open questions in the field. There's a kind of a spectrum with maybe historical fiction on one end, a genre in which an author will take a basic historical event or a biography and embellish it very self-consciously as fiction, and the audience is aware that it's fictionalized, and it's, so nobody's being misled. But even when you stick to the facts, you may be injecting opinion and speculation so that your writing of creative nonfiction or nonfiction becomes a kind of polemic.
So are there subjects that shouldn't be handled that way? I mean, you write about spousal abuse. You've written about debutantes. You have written about a group of people who sun in the sun in bikinis. All nonfiction. You're writing a book about Shakespeare and its intersection with sports, which maybe we'll talk about later. But those seem to be innocuous subjects that you could – not innocuous. Spousal abuse is not innocuous.
Right.
But those are subjects that you could inject some opinion into, I suppose, particularly from a woman's point of view. But are there subjects that should not be tackled that way?
Well, I don't know if you can really reduce the question to should or should not. I think in my own opinion, there's more merit to fact-based writing that has evidence going for it, a preponderance of evidence. In my opinion, if you present the material and let the reader judge for himself or herself, if you show rather than tell, then to me that's a better accomplishment than if you take a few facts and then try to manipulate them so as to present just your opinion to the reader and not let the reader see the evidence or form his or her own opinion.
Now, Aaron, you're a fiction writer, and maybe a good example of where you crossed the line from nonfiction into fiction, but a fiction story based on reality or
right.
Something that actually happened, is your book, Wynne's War, which is a story of modern man fighting a war on horses, in this case, in Afghanistan. You grew up on a rural ranch in Oklahoma. How much of that experience informs this novel in terms of dealing with the horses of it all?
I think a good deal of it informs it. It always with fiction, I think your personal experience informs the work in the most unexpected of ways. So readers expect certain incidents they read in the novel to be drawn directly from your life. The thing, back to what Cynthia was saying about nonfiction, and we're talking about the line here, for the novel, the research I did for Wynne's War, I had to tone so much of what really happened down in order for it to be believed as nonfiction. The phrase, you know, the truth is always stranger than fiction. And sometimes the truth is more implausible than fiction is some of the things that I've found. I've written a little bit of creative nonfiction essays, never a book of nonfiction. But I know writing short stories, writing novels, in order to be believed, you feel like, well, I'm going to have to, if it's based on something that actually happened, I'm going to have to tone this down.
Wow. It's been said that writers write what they know, but you have said that's the worst advice you can ever give to a writer.
In a particular way, I think when you tell students write what you know, what they hear is write what you already know. As opposed to, oh, well, you want to write about a fighter pilot and you've never even sat in the plane. Well, then you go do the research. You go do the, you know, the book research, the internet research. You go talk to fighter pilots. You see if there's a plane you can sit in. You go, you do a flight simulator. And so you acquire the requisite, technical knowledge and the sensory knowledge in the way maybe an actor would if he or she were preparing for a role. So, yeah, I think, yes, definitely write what you know, or backwards, know what you write. But just because you don't know about something and you want to write about it is not a reason not to research and write yourself into a knowledge of it.
Do the three of you find that you sometimes don't know what you know until you write it?
Oh, very much.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Even in poetry?
Sure. Yeah, I how do you know what you think until you see what you say? And so sometimes you surprise yourself with the things that you know when you write it down.
So for a poet or a novelist writing in fiction, I don't know whether you outline the poem before you write it or we outline the stories before you write them, whether they short stories or novels, but I've heard authors say that if you start writing, sometimes the characters do what they want to do, not something that you plan for them to do. And maybe the same thing can happen in poetry. It can go someplace down a road that you hadn't planned to go down because that's where it goes.
I'm still thinking about the research I did for this novel. I talked to a lot of special operators, and what they'll say is no plan survives first contact. So you can have a conception of what you want to do, what you want to accomplish, but once language begins to do its work on the page, once you have invented characters and they have a psychology and a motivation, I would imagine the same is true for poetry in that poetry acquires its own logic and its own needs that wrest control away from authors in certain ways.
Absolutely. It's like riding a horse. You may be steering with the reins, but ultimately the horse is the thing that's getting you there. And when you're going full clip, you don't really have all that much control, and you shouldn't. You shouldn't want it.
Right. Mm. That's it. Not having control. I think you try to write in this sort of way, if it's really genuine, it's really flowing, that you are out of control. I mean, it's the Greek word for ecstasy means to be, to be taken possession of.
And you agree with that? From a nonfiction writing point of view, you're
very much so.
But so I'm trying to understand this. As you're sitting there and writing, you just let it go. Get out of the way, let it happen.
Well, but then you have to bring it back into control. I mean,
control is in the editing.
Right.
You read what you wrote after it's written, after you've let the stuff flow out of your fingertips. You read what you've written, and then you have control over it because you can edit. Is that fundamentally what happens or not?
Yeah, I mean, I teach a lot of writing to undergraduates, and when an undergraduate comes up to me and says, I want to write my paper, and this is a lit crit paper, my paper about blah, 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 and my thesis is...
Well, hold that thought, because we have to take a break. It's a good place. It's a cliffhanger. We'll come back in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and PNC Wealth Management, with over 160 years of experience and a team of financial professionals committed to helping clients achieve financial goals. More from Jennifer Green at 704-686-2129. And HealthWorks by Carolina Healthcare System, working with employers to improve health through targeted healthcare programs. It takes a partnership, working together as one. carolinashealthcare.org/HealthWorks. We're talking football. That's football with a U. In other words, soccer tomorrow. Interest in soccer has been slow to build in this country when compared to the rest of the world, but the recent World Cup That did kind of wonders to build interest. And next year, I didn't know this, but we are getting our own professional soccer team. We already have one, but they take the field next year, the Charlotte Independents. We'll talk to one of the executives of that, a coach of the Davidson soccer team, which is highly successful, all tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation is earning more than $3 billion from its investment in a new drug. Other charitable organizations are hoping to follow a similar path. New questions about mixed motivations for nonprofits.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Going into the master class that will be taught this year, this weekend by the three guests in our studio here for the North Carolina Writers Network Fall Conference, we've invited three writers to join us to talk about the process, to talk about writing various different genres, and to talk about what's been happening in the digital world, in the publishing and world, and how they get their material to you in this new digital age. Maury Creech is with us. He is a professor of creative writing at Queen's University, the author of three collections of poetry, the latest of which was a nominee for the 2014 Pulitzer Prize, The Sleep of Reason. Cynthia Lewis is from Davidson College, a nonfiction writer. Her new book's coming out shortly, called The Games Afoot, Sports and Shakespeare. And Aaron Gwynn is a writer of short stories and novels. He's written short stories for Esquire and other publications. His latest novel is called Wind's War, and he's a professor of English at UNC Charlotte. Now, get back to you, Cynthia, because you were in the middle of an explanation.
It's just an example of what we're talking about, I think, when we refer to giving up control over your writing. If a student approaches me and says, I want to write my paper on such and so, and my thesis is, and the student hasn't even begun to write, I'll say, you know, I don't trust your knowing your thesis right away. If you already know what you're going to conclude, then writing won't really be a process of discovery for you. You won't really have to be doing any kind of intellectual work. So just start where the idea is clearest to you and work your way from there. And you really ought to end up in a place that's very different from what you thought you were going to do when you started. And that will be a real accomplishment.
Do you all work that way?
There's no one way for me that a story starts. You know, often I have a kind of story full blown in the sense of I have incident, I have a conflict that I feel like, oh, it's going to lead to this and lead to this. But at some point, characters that you in quotation marks have created begin to do what they do. And sometimes you need them to go into the room, you need them to drive the car, and they can't, they won't, they refuse. And if you force that, the story begins to seem false. The whole thing can go off the rails pretty quickly.
Wow. What about poetry?
Well, a good example is I write in rhyme and meter, which is, I had a professor once who said, okay, I want everybody to write a sonnet. And we all wrote a sonnet. And he said, well, how did it go? And I said, well, it was okay, but it really made it hard to say what I wanted to say. And he said, exactly. The whole point of it is that it forces you out of the rut of ordinary thinking, the kinds of things that immediately come to your mind, and it forces you to give up some of the control that you have over your subject matter and say something that you are altogether surprised by. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes giving yourself exercises or finding ways to circumvent your normal pattern of thinking is the thing that you're trying to do.
And yet you have in your Pulitzer Prize-nominated book of poetry, The Sleep of Reason, you have a set of poems called Song and Complaint, which are, I guess, a tip of the hat to John Keats and his Ode to a Nightingale.
That's right.
But there are lots of references scattered throughout this to other poets and other poems. That seems to me, that cannot be free-flowing. I mean, that has to be something that you really, maybe I'm wrong, have to plot out to work all of those references into the piece.
They happen organically. You do a lot of reading and you love a lot of poetry and it just kind of gets absorbed into your marrow, and And when you're writing, something seems really appropriate at a moment, at a particular moment in the composition of the poem, and it just happens on its own. It's not plotted out at all. It's really so surprising.
There are a couple of theater pieces that I'm familiar with that are very inside, in that if you know all of the references that are contained in the play, mm-hmm. then it's hysterically funny or it's wildly smart. Mm-hmm. But if you don't know the references, people are reluctant to produce them and stage them because you don't know the references, and it won't be funny or people won't get it. Did that cross your mind when you wrote Song and Complaint? If people don't know who all of these poets are and what they wrote and where this line comes from, even the first line of the poem is "Beat it, bird," and it's about the nightingale. I mean, if you don't know that, can you enjoy it?
I think you can, but I think the ideal is that you write something that has a sort of surface appeal. And then the deeper you investigate and investigate the poem, the more it yields itself to your understanding and the more it enriches your experience.
All of you are published writers, but there was that first work that got published, which I want to talk about. And we want to ask our listeners on Twitter, as readers, how do you learn about new authors? And if you're a writer, how do you find your inspirations? And you can send us your responses at WFAE on Twitter. How did you first get published, the three of you? Cynthia?
I started publishing academic scholarships, so because I had to publish or perish, pretty much. And I had been teaching creative nonfiction for a long time and began to feel irresponsible by not actually publishing some. And I was a little tired of writing the same old Shakespeare scholarship, so I decided to try my hand at creative nonfiction and absolutely fell in love with it. My first long piece was about the serial bomber Eric Rudolph, who was still at large when I began researching him in the western North Carolina mountains. Mm. And there was a kick. I mean, here was a school marm off interviewing FBI agents and sheriffs in Cherokee County. It was really different.
But you enjoyed it.
I loved it.
And how did you get that piece published?
I sent it to a publication called Southern Cultures, which is a semi-popular periodical published at UNC Chapel Hill at the Center for the Study of the American South, because I thought that they would be interested in the subject matter, but they published specifically Southern pieces, and they were interested, and they published it.
Difficult to get poetry published, Maury?
Yeah, I sent poems out so much that I would get letters of rejection that the standard rejection was, please feel free to submit again anytime. Mm-hmm. With someone would have put a line through that. I would meet the mailman as he was handing me the rejection. I was handing him a fresh submission to the same magazine. So I was stubborn, but it was hard.
Yeah. There are fewer opportunities, I would think, for poets.
Well, there are a lot of little magazines out there that you can get published in. So the first magazine I got published in, they published the title and of the poem in the table of contents, but then the poem was nowhere in the magazine. So that was my first experience with publication. It was,
nowhere to go but up.
That would make it difficult for you, Aaron. Because
my goodness.
I understand that you don't keep any drafts and you don't keep anything that gets published except one copy of it, and that has to be in its published form.
That's
so
right.
If your work had appeared only in the table of contents,
it'd be gone.
You'd be done. So, what was your experience the first time?
I'm like Maury. I sent out. I tried to write short stories. And then would send out stories. Now looking back, before they were ready to be published, and then finally, I wrote one that worked, that stood up, and was published by a magazine, and then a literary agent read the magazine and got in contact with me. And so from that story, things sort of began to roll, but it took a while.
But did you experience the kind of rejection?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Oh, good grief. Yeah, but Maury said it. I was stubborn. I wasn't if you don't take no for an answer, eventually the answer comes back yes.
Well, talk about that, because I hear this. We've done shows like this before where we talk to successful authors and people want to know, well, how did you get published? Because I just keep sending stuff out and it gets sent back with a rejection letter. And how do you know when you should keep going? Because by God, I'm good. You just don't know that. You just don't know it yet. Versus maybe they're trying to tell me something. Maybe I ought not quit my day job.
Whew.
I think it's important to listen to rejection and the criticism that emanates from rejection at the same time that publishing is a little bit like dating. You know, you have to find the right match. So a piece that's rejected by one publication may be embraced and proposed to by another little magazine or publication.
Do you always hear back? Do you always get a rejection letter or an acceptance letter, or does it sometimes just never come back to you and they never respond to you?
I think I've always heard something.
Okay.
Often this is what Maury's describing. You know, you get these little, at the start, these form letters, these little slips of paper, like almost like scratch paper, and, you know, it's the same thing, you know. Though we respect your work, or, you know, we've received far too many submissions to ever tell you why we're rejecting your story.
So they never tell you why. So how can you learn
from that? Very rarely, and that's really hard.
How can you learn from that? I mean, maybe it is something you've done or not done, or the way you write that could be corrected if you only knew it, but no one's telling you that. Or maybe it's just that it didn't strike a nerve with them, but it will with the next person. So how do you learn?
Well, I think one of the things that happens is you begin to investigate the places that you're sending, and you see the kinds of tastes that the editors have, mm-hmm. and you begin to learn what some editors are going to go for and what other editors are not going to go for. And so a knowledge of the market and a knowledge of what magazines you're sending to really helps you to shape your work and shape where you send.
Well, we're kind of talking about the traditional paradigm here, where you have to get an agent and the agent talks to publishers and the publisher either picks up your work or not, or the magazine picks up your short story or not, and you're at their mercy. But now we have this digital world that we live in, and that's led to self-publishing, people doing it themselves. Has the object of writing, I would think, aside from the catharsis it may provide you as you're writing, is to get people to read it. Am I right?
Absolutely.
We all want people to read.
Absolutely. Okay. You wouldn't write it if you didn't want to read it.
So has self-publishing made it easier for writers to find an audience? It certainly made it easier to get it published if you have the funds and the gumption to do it. But will it find an audience? Is that something that really requires the operation involved at a Random House or a Scribner's or someplace like that? Because there's no publicity. If you don't do it, if you're self-published, if you don't do it, Simon & Schuster ain't going to do it for you.
You're going to find outliers. You're going to find stories where people have published something themselves on Kindle, or, you know, they've gotten it out there and people have connected with it, and that leads to a book deal with Simon & Schuster and Penguin, mm-hmm. Random House, etc. However, book culture and large publishing is driven by, are people going to a bookstore? Are they going to Amazon? Are they spending money on a particular thing? And you are rewarded by a publishing house up front with an advance based on, this is how much we're willing to invest, and how much they are willing to invest means this is the kind of publicity we're going to put out. This is how we're going to get behind the book. Everyone likes money, but money, it does not just function as, you know, here's a lump sum of cash. Money is also a publisher's way of telling the author, this is how much we're going to stand behind this book and push it. That's a big thing. I didn't understand at first.
Mm. Would you suggest to people who have been rejected and rejected and rejected and rejected that self-publishing is a legitimate avenue and one they ought to think about pursuing? If their goal is to do something other than sit at their computer or their typewriter or in front of a legal pad, in your case, Aaron, I'm told, writing in longhand until you put it right into a Word document, if that's all you want to do is sit there and write, that's okay. You can sit in the drawer. But if you really want to get to readers, would you suggest people self-publish if they can't find a publisher?
Well, as poets, the poets aren't big sellers anyway. So, you know, even if you're published you're not self-publishing, you're publishing with a press, there's no guarantee that you're going to reach a large readership anyway. To self-publish is to have maybe less of a chance even than that of reaching a readership. So, there's something kind of liberating about knowing that there's not a huge audience out there that's, you know, you're not in a competitive market, so you can kind of do what you want.
Would you do it? Would the three of you do it? If you had a work that you really believed in that couldn't find a publisher, would you take that avenue?
I would not.
Why not?
I personally, and this is not this, you know, casting aspersion on anyone out there who's doing self-publishing, I personally would not feel that that publication was legitimate. So I'm looking for approval, both from readers, but I'm looking for approval from an establishment of, you know, hopefully peers who are saying, no, we believe in this. We see value. We have values such as you do, and we see the merit of this, and we're willing to stand behind this.
You all teach young people. Is that a generational thing? Or do you think that younger people who are so hip to the digital world don't really see the distinction? I mean, they don't see the distinction particularly in ABC, NBC, CBS, NPR. News comes on their phone. So they don't care whether it comes from a big organization. If it's true, that's all they care about. Do they care about whether it comes from Simon & Schuster or whether somebody self-published, if they read it and they like it? So has that stigma gone away, I guess?
In some ways, I think social media has gone a long way toward transforming this landscape, because now you have YouTube and somebody can just make a huge celebrity killing on YouTube with, you know, a picture of a cat, pretty much.
Absolutely. That's right.
And you have bloggers. I mean, another way toward getting published is to become a successful blogger who collects readers, you know, kind of a following, just as people have followings on Twitter and so forth. So in a way, social media have broken down the barriers between those works that are vetted by the establishment Aaron's talking about and just people coming forward with what they got. And if it's liked, it's liked, and, you know, so much the better. But I still agree with Aaron that just because it's on YouTube, just because it's on your blog, doesn't make it good. What makes it good is a certain approbation that you receive from a community of established writers.
But see, the exact opposite has happened in the music world. The digital revolution has destroyed the music industry pretty much.
Absolutely.
Nobody wants to pay for it anymore from the consumer's point of view. And record stores have gone away. The legitimacy of being on Columbia Records or RCA Records has gone away. If you got a song, you put it on the internet. If people like it, they listen to it, and that's how it works now. That's not happening with writing?
It is happening with writing. I think it most definitely is. Publishing shrunk after 2008, after the financial collapse, and books are one of the first things people stop buying when finances get hit hard.
Aaron Gwynn is a writer of short stories and novels. His latest novel is called Winds War. He's here along with Cynthia Lewis and Maury Creech, and we'll come back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and International Arts Foundation, presenting Africa Umoja, the Spirit of Togetherness, celebrating 20 years of freedom and democracy in South Africa. Today through Saturday, Night Theater, tickets at umojausatour.com. And Diamonds Direct South Park, offering certified diamonds direct from their own diamond cutters in Tel Aviv, and engagement rings from international designers, including Tacori, Jeff Cooper, and Simon G. Diamonds-direct.com. Well, a windfall for the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation is the topic of the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, along with new questions about mixed motivations for nonprofits. That's what they're talking about. We're talking about writing and writers and publishing, etc. And if you would like to join our conversation, you can get to us at Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. Yeah, it's been a long haul, but there is progress in California schools.
It's actually pretty good. It's like a home-cooked meal, except that at school.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, replacing tater tots with broccoli and getting locally grown food on the school lunch menu. It's next time on Marketplace. It's from APM.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about writing with three writers, successful writers. Maury Creech is a poet whose book, The Sleep of Reason, his collection of poetry, was a nominee for the 2014 Pulitzer Prize. Cynthia Lewis, a nonfiction writer who's been on this program before, talking about a number of her books, and the latest of which is going to be called The Games Afoot, Sports and Shakespeare. Aaron Gwynn is a writer of short stories and novels, and his latest one is called, well, his novel is called Wind's War. All three of them teach at area universities. Maury Creech at Queens, University of Charlotte, Cynthia Lewis at Davidson College, Aaron Gwynn at UNC Charlotte. Before we move on, you talked about the legitimacy, Aaron, of being published by a named publisher as opposed to self-publishing. Do readers require, do they see a value in that legitimacy?
I think they would be aware of it even if, on some level, if an editor at a major publisher and a copy editor and all the design people, everything that goes into carefully making a book, and there's a, you know, there's a lot of effort that goes into this besides what the author does, I think you remove that process. Mm-hmm. I think readers would know something is off, something is different. There is...
I don't know which came first for you, writing novels or short stories.
Stories.
Okay. So, and you've had your short stories published in Esquire and other publications. You've written for NPR.com. Your writing has appeared in the Huffington Post. If you have a series of articles published or short stories published, are you more likely to be able to get a publisher for a novel?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, that's the first thing. If you are contacted by an agent or an editor becomes interested in you, they're like, oh, we read your short story, and you're hoping they'll say, do you have a collection? But they say, do you have a novel? I mean, so the very few publishers want to do a collection of stories.
Why not? Because you know, the HBO just did Olive Kitteridge,
sure,
which arguably, I think, is a collection of short stories. It's about the same character.
It is.
But it's a collection of short stories, and they did it masterfully, I think. So,
sure.
And to read that book, mm-hmm, is wonderful. It's a,
sure,
wonderful experience.
Absolutely.
So why would they be reluctant? We have such short attention spans now. Why would people not want to read a collection of short stories?
You would think that it would be the perfect form for – or that poetry would be the perfect form. It's an even shorter,
yes,
form, condensed, compressed. You can sit down – you know, Poe in The Philosophy of Composition, I'm paraphrasing here, but he basically says if your butt gets tired, it's too long. You should sit down, take it in one sitting, right? You would,
yeah,
think it would be the perfect thing, but we still have the idea that in publishing this long book, the nonfiction book, the weighty nonfiction book or the novel is king, and you're getting more for your money. This is America. If I pay $25 for a book, I want it to be 550 pages long.
Nonfiction, I'm told, at least at the moment, outsells fiction. Is that because we have so many other avenues for fiction where we can digest the material lazily? Television, movies.
Sure.
You don't have to work. You just sit there and it flows over you.
Sure, sure. I mean, the dominant mode of storytelling is, well, it used to be film. I think the dominant mode for storytelling now that Breaking Bad and Deadwood is up the ante is television.
Yeah.
I think that's great.
Yeah. Hmm. What about poetry? Is the problem with poetry that we think it's so difficult, or that we have bad experiences with poetry as students in school, where we're told to write a poem and we sit there, roses are red, violets are blue. It all has to rhyme, and we know it doesn't have to rhyme. But is that the problem? We don't get a good education in what poetry is and what it can do for you as the reader.
Well, I mean, I think about you're brought up on prose, and you know, to have someone sit down and read something in a paragraph is not particularly challenging for most people because they're brought up on prose. If we were brought up reading poems and reading poems seriously from elementary school on, I don't think it would be so challenging to figure out how to you know, glean the meaning from a poem. But we're not educated in that way. Poetry is a sort of ancillary to the education of reading.
I have to ask you this because I don't know that I've ever talked to anybody who's been a Pulitzer Prize nominee. I've talked to Nobel Prize winners, but I don't think I've talked to Pulitzer winners or nominees. But I have talked to an author who was chosen by Oprah to be on the book club, and it changed his life, he said. And he said, everything about my life is completely different now simply because she mentioned my book. What does getting a nomination for a Pulitzer do for a poet?
Really, the week or a couple of weeks after the announcement, my book sales spiked because people want to buy the winner and also read the finalists as well. Mm-hmm. And so for a short period of time, people were buying my book, and that was really exciting and gratifying. But aside from that, not a whole lot. You get a letter from Columbia University saying congratulations to you. You know? That's about it.
Shakespeare is commonly referred to as the greatest writer in the history of the English language. I have my own phrase for Shakespeare because I find him incredibly challenged, and I can't say it on the radio.
I can guess.
There are lots of words. Lots of words to get an idea across. But they had a lot of time back then to spend in the theater. You try to make him accessible. That's your job as a teacher. And your latest book, The Games Afoot, Sports and Shakespeare, you're using sports to explain what's going on in Shakespeare. Is that right?
Sort of. I'm using a sports analogy with a play as a bridge to draw a potential reader of Shakespeare into a play through that reader's interest in the sports example. So if you can appreciate, just to really make this elementary, if you can appreciate the rivalry between the Lakers and the Celtics, then I'm saying you can appreciate the long-lived rivalry between the Capulets and the Montagues. And then you kind of go off from there. But the book is really about Shakespeare. It's just trying to show, well, first of all, the analogy between spectator sports and the theater. Mm-hmm. They're very similar in lots of ways, not least of which is the performance in front of a live audience. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, just to sort of demystify Shakespeare, the sort of high culture in our society, anyway, by showing that it's really a lot more human.
Yeah. Well, he was writing for the masses. Mm-hmm. He was the Neil Simon of his day, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean,
Beatles. Mm-hmm. Beatles of his day. Yeah. But there was one of them.
So, and do you think that this will help people, this book about sports and Shakespeare?
I'd like to think that. Okay. I don't think I would have written it if I didn't think that it would perhaps reach an audience that otherwise wouldn't be reached for Shakespeare.
Now, all three of you teach. You're all successful and published authors, and you all three teach at various colleges and universities around the area. Is that something that's been going on forever in the literary world, or is that something that's a new phenomenon?
Well, I think that it's been going on for a long time in the sense that, it's pretty common for, historically for writers to be in academia, but I think teaching creative writing is a new thing.
Ah.
It's a new a new outlet for creative expression in classroom is being taught by professors is a new thing. I think about it as in some ways we used to have a patronage system and writers would find patrons who would help to finance their literary careers and help them along in attaining success. And university system is in some ways the new patronage for writers. Writers find the time, they find financial backing, they find encouragement, they find a way to sustain their writing while teaching in the university, and then also they have the opportunity to talk about what they love.
And since you're working with young people and you're trying to teach them what you know, does that inform what you know? Does it help you as a writer to teach others how to do what you do?
Absolutely.
I think so. Absolutely, yeah.
It helps you find it's forced me to find a vocabulary to try to express my own aesthetic. I have these things that I like. I have these things that I attempt to do. I have these things I value in other people's books and in nonfiction, poetry, fiction. And now I have to say, well, listen, you, my students, you guys have to begin to build an aesthetic as well, and I have to be able to transmit, here are the things a novel ought to have. Here are the things a short story ought to have or a poem ought to have. Here are the things we believe that this piece of work should do, and here's how you accomplish that. Here are the techniques by which you accomplish that.
Can it be taught? You've all been teaching for a while, I'm sure, and God knows writing has been taught forever. But can it be taught, or do you have to really have a natural talent for it, where all you're doing as the teacher is working like a sculptor and chiseling off little pieces here and there, maybe adding something here? But if the natural talent doesn't exist, can it be taught?
Technique can be taught.
Technique can be taught. I think writing is a – I don't want to talk – I'm talking too much. Writing is a physical activity, though we think of it as an intellectual activity. Writing is a physical activity. Just as you would develop chops on the piano and would sit there and do exercises day after day, just as LeBron James is going to go out of the court and shoot countless free throws and run drills, a writer has to be there present every day during his apprentice period, her apprentice period, writing, practicing, failing, getting up and doing it over and over and over again. And if a person has the requisite talent to play basketball, to play the piano, to write, then is willing to put in the hard work and put in the time.
And be coached.
And be coached and fail and keep moving forward and work ethic and all of that and some luck, then I think you can get somewhere.
And when you talk about it being a physical process, for you it is, because you write in longhand and then at some point you type it into Word.
I do.
Why do you write it in longhand? That seems incredibly laborious to me.
I can't type, for one. So everything I do is – so that's one thing, right? So I'm still hunting and pecking. I've been working on laptops and computers 15-something years now, and I'm still hunting and pecking. And I can write – it feels more like myself when I write longhand. And I like that there is another level of drafting, yet another layer to get through. So I'm sifting down through – all of this stuff.
How do you as a poet do it? Because poetry, it seems to me, to be difficult to type because it has to look a certain way on the page.
It's actually pretty easy to do. And I do everything. I type 55 or 60 words a minute. So I can actually think. My typing can keep up with my thinking, whereas when I write longhand, I feel like my hand is lagging behind what I want to say. And it's just a matter of writing on a piece of paper is technology. Using a computer is technology. It's all technology.
Right.
So it's just a matter of preference, I think.
That's right. I'm old enough that I went through the transition from longhand to computers, and I used to do everything by longhand because that's when your TypeScript was so hard to produce that you had to be pretty sure what you wanted to put down or you're going to have to do the whole thing over again. So for a long time, I resisted composing on a computer. Now I do, but with the proviso that I never turn anything in without editing on hard copy, and that's my layer. And I advise all my students to do the same thing. Never just edit on a computer screen, because when you produce it in a different form, even though it's basically a mirror of what you see on the computer screen, when it's on a piece of paper, it will look different, and you will catch revisions you want to make that you wouldn't if you were looking at
That's
it
great
on the screen.
Advice.
That's absolutely
wow.
Right.
Okay, Ken, stuck on I-77 emails. National Book Club Awards took place yesterday. There was a theme of blasting Amazon as a publisher. I know you buy your books, Aaron, from Amazon. Can your guest speak to the publisher's role and value versus the distributor, Amazon versus self-publishing, and maybe more importantly, self-editing. Amazon is at war with one of these publishers, Hachette, I think.
They made peace yesterday.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
Hachette and Amazon have signed a deal, and for The deal is has been undisclosed as to its particulars, but they've kissed and made up. The war is over.
So you don't have a problem with Amazon?
If I did, I certainly wouldn't say it.
You wouldn't say it on the air. Martin emails, I developed a passion for creative fiction too late in college to switch my major. I wonder what advice the panelists might have for a professional adult who would still love to pursue the craft. How important is formal education for the creative writer?
That's a good question.
It's a great question.
Yeah.
I mean, can you just sit down and start writing?
You can. I think that a lot of what you learn in from technique, you can learn in a classroom, but you can also learn it with a library card.
That's
you
right.
Know, you can go and learn how to I have a very good friend, a poet named Jennifer Reeser, who writes wonderfully crafted poems. And I asked her, well, where did you study? And she just looked at me and she said, in my kitchen. I got a library card and I read books about prosody and I started writing poetry that way.
David on Facebook, I write creative nonfiction nearly every day and often get immediate response. I write for eyeballs, which are at the moment on Facebook. Since there are now a trillion options waiting for the waiting in the queue, works will necessarily become shorter, even as short as a Facebook post. Tip jars come next, thus freedom from gatekeepers. Tip jars, really? Well, just write for Twitter. 140 characters, your job is done.
What's that? What's that pay? Is what
that's the other problem. How do you monetize something that you do? And is that important? Is the money, obviously the money is important because everybody has to eat and pay the rent.
That's right.
But you'd still do it if you didn't get paid, right?
I don't get paid. So, I mean, I make such a marginal amount of money writing poetry that it doesn't really.
That's Maury Creech. Send your collections here. The Sleep of Reason, a 2014 Pulitzer Prize nominee, Cynthia Lewis, Aaron Gwynn. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7.